feel like Madonna. Thank you all so much for coming. I get to go to many food justice conferences, but there's a really good energy here, and I'm really excited to be part of this. Not least because things are dark right now. In fact, Lucy, since we met, the number of hungry people has gone up. Today, there are now 1 billion people who are getting less than 1,900 calories a day. And at the same time, there are 1 billion people around the world who are overweight. I don't have anything terribly sophisticated to offer in terms of analysis or PowerPoint, but I notice a whiteboard here, so I'm just going to trundle over here. And instead of a PowerPoint, I'm going to ask you to use your imaginations, which is kicking it old school, I believe. This is kind of a diagram of how... All right. This is a diagram about basically the kind of world we find ourselves in. I have to stare at this, otherwise the feedback kind of kills it. But at the top, if you imagine all the farmers in the world, the millions of farmers around the world who produce the food that we eat every day. And at the bottom, nearly 7 billion people on Earth today who eat every day if we can. And in the middle, as arbiters of the food that goes from farmers to us, as just a handful of corporations. And this sort of hourglass diagram is a very sort of back-of-envelope representation of the way the world food system works. But it is an accurate one. In the world today, in every major commodity, in every major food commodity, whatever that commodity is, there are usually sort of 5 or 6 corporations that control the global trade in that commodity. It varies according to the thing that we're talking about. You know, the global market in tea, for example. The world's market in packaged tea is 94% controlled by one corporation, by Unilever. 94% of the global market is controlled by just one corporation. But in every major sort of commodity market, there is sort of 4, 5 or 6. In grain, in the global trade in grain, there's like an ABCD of these corporations. There's Archer Daniels Midland, Bunge, Cargill, and Dreyfus. These are the corporations that sort of run the global grain market. And you may think, well, you know, maybe it's all right to have corporations distributing our food for us. Because, you know, when you have corporations competing, you win. Or so we are told on late-night television. But of course, in the global market in food, there is no such thing as a free market. And particularly when it comes to food, there's not really that much competition. Now, you don't have to take my word for it. You can believe the words of a man named Duane Andreas. And Duane Andreas, when he said the quote that I'm about to give you, was the chairman of Archer Daniels Midland, one of the largest corporations involved in the manufacture of food. And he had to say this about competition. He said, the customer is our enemy, and the competitor is our friend. And there is not one grain of anything in the world that is sold in a free market. Not one. The only place that you see free markets are in the speeches of politicians. People who are not from the Midwest do not realize that this is a socialist country. That's an odd thing for a CEO of a top, sort of Fortune 500 company to be saying. To be saying that, that actually we don't live in a free market. We live in a world where corporations are basically suckle on the teat of government money. A couple of years ago, when I was sort of trying to explain this to people, particularly in America, people saying, "Well, that's not true. We would never have corporations holding out their hands and the governments giving away trillions of dollars." So it's a little easier to explain that now. And we kind of understand that that's the situation we live in. But we ought to understand that that is also why it is that we live in a world where people go hungry and where people are overweight. Because if the corporations in the middle of that bottleneck want to stay where they are, if they want to stay profitable, they will do two things. Firstly, they will manufacture goods that are profitable for them. Things that mean that the things that are highly processed, things that have salt and fat and sugar in them, the sort of things our bodies are hardwired to crave. It is profitable to make people overweight. And so the companies that are in the position to be able to sell these highly processed foods have every incentive to shift them onto us as far as they can. The other thing that corporations do is pay very little for the inputs that go into making their food. And the hungriest people in the world today are the people who grow the food. The poorest people on Earth, and therefore the hungriest people on Earth, are, ironically, farm workers. People who work in agriculture, making our food for us. And that's a contradiction that isn't accidental. That's to do with the way the world works. And it's to do with the way that we have allowed corporations to be able to run our food system. And in a sense, we shouldn't be surprised by this. We shouldn't be surprised that corporations will evade regulation, that they will lie to us and cheat and steal and break the law if they can get away with it. It is absolutely reasonable to expect the CEO of a Fortune 500 company to try and get government to ignore regulation about genetically modified organisms, for example. Because as an employee of this organization, his job, and it's usually a he, his job is to maximize profit for his shareholders. And if he does not maximize profit, then he will be out, because those are the rules of the game. And if he does not underpay his workers, and if he does not drive down the price that the poorest people receive for their wages, then he's not doing a good job as a CEO. We shouldn't be surprised by any of this. We shouldn't be surprised that corporations commit capitalist acts. Because those are the rules of the game. We should be asking a much more interesting question. The question we should ask is, why do we have markets in food at all? Why do we have markets in food? Because historically it's weird. The world's first global market in food was the global market in wheat. And that was only really completed in about 130 years ago. Historically it's very new to have these global markets. And to understand why we have these global markets and whose interests they serve, let me take you on a historical journey to India, which was one of the sort of epicenters of the global market in wheat. Now, before the British arrived in India, India was a feudal economy. And what that means is that India had a lot of landlords who owned tons of land. And on that land were toiled peasants. And the peasants worked and they produced the food. And the landlord would take that food away and give back to the peasant just enough for them to survive. It was feudalism. It was an awful system. The only silver lining was that in times of famine, when the rains didn't come, when the crops were decimated by pests, it was the landlord's responsibility to feed the hungry. Right? So it's a crap system, but at the end of the day, at least people tend not to go hungry under feudalism. So the British arrived, and they saw landlords giving away food for free. And the British said, landlords, you don't need to be giving away things for free. What you need is markets. Markets are terrific. You will find that when you introduce markets in food, a number of things will happen. Your productivity will go up because you will have incentives to produce more food than you need. You'll be able to sell that surplus and you'll become rich beyond the dreams of man. And also, you won't have to give away stuff for free because you will employ your workers and they will buy food with their money. And there'll be none of this handout business. And instead, we'll have an efficient, tightly working market economy. And the Indians said, the landlords said, no thanks. Actually, we're fine. And the British said, no, we have guns. And so it was. Often down the barrel of a gun. The British imposed these markets in food. And to some extent, of course, the British did not lie. It is true that after the British imposed these markets in food, Indian agricultural productivity went through the roof. India exported millions of tons of grain, wheat in particular, to Britain. More food than ever before in India's history. More food per person. This was why the British introduced these markets. They wanted cheap grain from India to feed their workers in Britain. And of course, that's what happens when you introduce markets. When you introduce markets, you introduce two very simple rules. The first rule is, if you have money, you get to eat. Even if that food comes from halfway around the world, you get to eat. And of course, that's, you know, that was the conduit, that was the mechanism through which food circled the world in order to feed workers in Manchester and Liverpool. But there's a second rule with markets, and that rule is that if you don't have money, you starve. And there are plenty of stories of workers loading sacks of wheat onto trains that would end up in Bombay that would then circle the world. Those workers died of hunger as they loaded the bags of grain onto the trains. And they died of hunger not because there was a shortage of food. There was more food produced than ever before in history. They didn't die because there was, they were unable to access the food. The food was right there. It was on their backs. The reason people starved was because the way that we distribute food is through the market. And those people were too poor to be able to afford that food. And that's something, that's a lesson for today. Because in the United States today, according to one survey over Christmas, one in five Americans, 60 million Americans, went hungry. Now you can't say that this is because America is overpopulated. You cannot say that this is because America lacks food. You go into any supermarket and you will see aisles of food. The reason people go hungry in the United States, as anywhere else in the world, is not for a shortage of food, but because the way we distribute food is through the market, and the poor are too poor to be able to afford it. This sort of spread of markets is something that is continuing today. And again, if you want to see the sort of impact of modern globalization and of markets gone wild, the place to look is India. To many people in the United States, India is kind of the place where all the high-tech jobs have gone. India is the land where everyone has a PhD in computer science, and people are defragmenting hard drives on street corners, chisels apparently. Everyone in India can tell you how to use Windows Vista, which is absurd. I mean, no one can tell you how to use Windows Vista. There is this sort of myth. And if you go to Bangalore, for example, you will see the sort of glittering towers of information technology capitalism. You'll see your Infosys and your Google and your Microsoft and what have you. But India is still an agricultural country. It is one in six of the world's farmers is Indian. And so the stories that matter most in India are not stories about Windows Vista. They're stories about agriculture. And in India, farmers have been having a particularly hard time of it of late. I'll give you a story of a family that's 5 hours out from Bangalore. A farmer, let's call him Kistaya. Kistaya had a wife, two kids, and a couple of acres. And like any entrepreneur, he wanted to leave the land better off than when he found it. And so, he does what every farmer does. He tried to improve his land. And so he borrowed money from the only place that he could. He borrowed money from the local moneylender. And he used it to drill a well that then he would use to irrigate his land. So he borrowed the money, and he drilled, and the well was dry. So now he was in trouble because he wanted to leave something better for his kids, but he needed to repay the moneylender. So he borrowed, and he drilled, and again, the well was dry. He borrowed, he drilled, and he borrowed, and he drilled five times in all. And one summer day, when the wet rains refused to come, he despaired. And that night, after his wife and kids had gone to bed, he pulled down a packet of pesticide called 4-8. It is illegal in the United States, though it is sold by U.S. corporations in India. And he mixed it with water, and he drank it. And it would have been an agonizing death. His nerves would have jammed, he would have asphyxiated. But he can't have convulsed very hard because he died without waking his wife and two kids. And all of this for a debt of $325. Now that tragedy is being repeated thousandfold in India. But you mustn't think that this is an Indian phenomenon. There's something sort of strangely subcontinental about this. I mean, this is happening the world over. It's happening in Australia, where farmers are being driven to the edge of despair by an incredible drought, being unable to service the debts that they have on their land, and then choosing to take their own lives. But you see it here in the United States, I was reading a horrific story of a farmer in upstate New York who slaughtered his cattle and then shot himself because, again, he was unable to pay his debt. And always the same story rebounds over and over again. It's a story about farmers pushed to the brink of debt, and then all of a sudden some minor tragedy that in better times they would be able to overcome will hit them. And that's the moment where they lose their land. And they don't just lose their land. They lose the land that has been in their families for generations. They lose their identity. They lose who they are. And rather than facing that oblivion, some farmers have chosen to take their own lives. But in India, this outbreak of farmer suicides has been accompanied by a range of other things. India is now home to record levels of people with type 2 diabetes. India is also now home to, in the latest Forbes list, 3 out of the top 10 richest men on earth are Indian. And also India is seeing levels of hunger among the poorest rise for the first time since the British left. And all of these are linked. And they're linked because of the spread of markets. Remember, we were talking about markets earlier on and the ways that markets spread. What happened in India in the early 1990s was something called economic liberalization. Economic liberalization just means that all of a sudden India allowed foreign corporations in. Previously, India had concentrated on developing its own industry and its own, you know, its own local capitalists, its own supporting its agriculture. But all of a sudden, the state was a bad idea. And so in the early 1990s, the state was shriveled back a little. And the winds of free markets were allowed to blow through the Indian economy. Well, that didn't work out well for farmers who had depended on the government to buy their crops on time and at a fair price. It didn't work out well for the hungry because their entitlements, their food aid that had been provided by the government was shrunk. It worked out well, of course, for the people who were already rich in India. The men who are billionaires now were already fantastically wealthy. And they were able to ride the flows of foreign capital to become among the world's richest people. And of course, it didn't work out well in terms of diabetes. Now, I don't know if you know this. I mean, there's a story behind the Indian diabetes epidemic. But the story has to do a lot with the influx of foreign corporations, of the kinds of corporations we're surrounded with here. Before 1990 in India, India didn't have Coke or Pepsi. For a generation, Coke and Pepsi had been kept out of the country. And instead, India had a local variety called Thumbs Up. I don't know if anyone's tried it. It's sort of an acquired taste. All of a sudden, Coke and Pepsi came into the country. Coca-Cola came in with their millions of marketing dollars, creating a market in these kinds of sort of sugary soft drinks. And they came in with their global Coke advert. And I don't know if any of you remember the global Coke advert in the early 1990s. It was about polar bears. Remember this, the polar bears, and they sort of waddle through the North Pole and they find Coke and they pick it up, flip it off. No idea how they don't have opposing thumbs. It's still there. They lay it on the Coke and they lean back, and Coke, and they watch the Northern Lights. So I don't know if any of you are familiar with Indian cultural iconography, but polar bears are not big in India. There are a lot of Indians watching this on the screen going, what the fuck's that? Pepsi had it right. Pepsi hired the Bollywood A-list. When Pepsi came in with their adverts, it was like, Pepsi, da 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 da. There's more where that came from. And they were a winner. Pepsi stole a march in the soft drinks market. But the tragedy, of course, is that whoever won, this battle between Coke and Pepsi, whoever won, India lost. It was kind of aliens versus predator. And the reason that's the case is because they should have asked me. I could have told them for nothing that South Asian bodies do not do well with the Western diet. I mean, I'm a second generation British Asian, so my family have been exposed to what passes for the Western diet for two generations. And there isn't a man over 50 in my family who doesn't have diabetes. You know, the rate for diabetes for white people in Britain is 4%, and for British Asians it's 20%. And, you know, every family that I know, every British Asian family knows someone who's, you know, who's blind, who's had amputation, who's had premature heart disease and you know, premature death as a result of this this epidemic. And you're seeing the figures rise in India from figures of diabetes around about 3% to figures in the cities at around about 13%. And that's why India today is the largest concentration of people with type 2 diabetes on Earth. And that's, you know, that's part of the dividend of globalization, the dividend of spreading markets and food and letting these corporations in to run the food system. And it's not just happening in India, of course, it's happening around the world. And it's happening, this process of market liberalization, of letting markets rule and by proxy letting corporations rule those markets and rule us. That's happening through organizations. Not just, you know, through governments, but through, sometimes governments are pushed in that direction, very often, through organizations like one that I used to work for, the World Bank. And I wanted to just give you a little sort of story about the World Bank and how that works. The World Bank is a... has anyone here seen Time Bandits? Those of you who haven't seen Time Bandits, it's a terrific film. It's sort of Monty Python-y kind of film. And the story in Time Bandits is that the universe was built in 6 days. So it was a rush job. And the universe has holes in it. And God doesn't treat his workers very well, so they run off with a map of the universe and they want to enrich themselves. And they use this map of the holes in the universe to rob people. So in one scene, they rob Napoleon. And they jump through a hole in the universe and they end up in Sherwood Forest. Where they are met by Robin Hood, who's played by John Cleese, as a sort of upper-class twit. He's wearing this sort of green pointy hat, and he introduces himself as Hood. Hood's very excited to see all of Napoleon's stuff, and he says, "Well, this is tremendous! Thank you very much indeed! The poor will love this! Have you met the poor?" Charming people. Of course, they don't have two pennies to rub together, but that's because they're poor. And so there's this lovely scene where Hood is giving away Napoleon's stuff. And again, bring on the poor! So the poor, of course, on this little line of poor people. And Hood works the line. He goes, "Rubies for you, yes, they are jolly good. And a gilded mirror for you, yes, how long have you been poor? Jolly good." And right next to Hood is this big bloke who takes whatever Hood has given and punches the person in the face. So that's how the World Bank works.